Hi, this podcast is brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I'm here today to talk about some of the exciting abstracts that were presented at the European Association of Neurology, some of which in conjunction with the American Association of Neurology in May 2020 virtually. The first one I wanted to talk about was the BEYOND study, which was presented by Dr. Isaacson. And this study looked at the long-term safety of a device ND0612, in idiopathic Parkinson's disease. Now, the ND0612, attractively named, is actually a pump. And it's a pump that is important for a distribution of levodopa and carbidopa in patients that's continually infused subcutaneously. So the unmet need that this particular device is attempting to address is really the on-off effect that is commonly seen in patients, especially with advanced Parkinson's disease, where the drugs are effective up to a certain time, and then until the next dose is taken and metabolized, there's going to be an off period. So it requires multiple doses throughout the day to try and control the symptoms, and continuous subcutaneous treatment with using the ND0612 may be more effective in managing the motor fluctuations and other symptoms of Parkinson's disease. That was the hypothesis. So the BEYOND study, it was a phase 2 study. It was open label, 1-year safety study in Parkinson's patients older than 30 years old who are taking at least 4 levodopa doses a day and more than one other Parkinson's medications. To be included, the patients were required to have more than 2 hours of off time per day with predictable early morning off periods. Participants received open-label ND0612 for either 24 hours or 16 hours, and they took adjunct oral PD medications as needed. A total of 214 patients were enrolled at 46 different sites in 8 countries. Overall, 2/3 of the patients were male, and the average age was about 64 years old. So the patients had been diagnosed for quite some time, with an average of 9 years since diagnosis, and the duration of motor fluctuations was 5.3 years plus or minus 4.2 years. So most patients had a levodopa baseline dose of about 1,000 milligrams. And of the 214 participants, half of them were appointed to the 16-hour regimen, whereas 90 of them received the 24-hour regimen. So the ND0612 pump was generally really well tolerated. The local infusion site reactions were transient and all manageable. Reported systemic treatment emergent adverse events were consistent with those expected for levodopa. And the most common adverse events were nodules, hematomas, and pain at the site of infusion. Overall, less than a quarter of the patients discontinued the study because of the adverse events, and serious treatment adverse events were really rare. At the end of the study, after 12 months, patients could continue treatment with the ND0612. Some of them are now in their 4th year. And of these participants, additional data is collected and the study will be extended. Next, I want to talk about an abstract looking at the real-world safety profiles of the 3 new migraine monoclonal antibodies that are on the market since 2018. Those are the 3 calcitonin gene-related peptide inhibitors, CGRP, that have been approved since 2018, and they've been in some post-marketing research for the last 6 months at least. And so that's ranibizumab, that's furmonazumab, and that's galcanezumab. And they were all shown to have a pretty reassuring safety profile in the real-world setting, happily. So the goal of this retrospective analysis was to gain insight into the real-world adverse event profiles of these CGRP inhibitors as preventative migraine treatments. And so they included were all the adverse events that were spontaneously reported to the FDA during the first 6 months post-approval, and for which the product was classified as the primary suspect. Many of the reported adverse events were injection site reactions, not too surprisingly, such as burn, pruritus, rash, and erythema. Migraine, headache, and drug ineffectiveness were reported for all 3 medications. Constipation ranked 2nd for ranibizumab, but was not in the top 10 adverse events for furmonazumab or galcanezumab. So cardiovascular events were not among the top 10 adverse events for any of these products. The top 5 reporting rates per 1,000 for all 3 CGRP inhibitors were for ranibizumab, the wrong technique, constipation, migraine, accidental exposure, and drug ineffectiveness. For furmonazumab, the most common were headache, drug ineffective, migraine, nausea, and injection site pain. And for galcanezumab, injection site pain, underdose, Headache, migraine, and ineffectiveness were the top adverse events. The results were all as expected based upon the clinical trial results, and longer-term safety data such as those on the approved CGRP inhibitors has been eagerly awaited since they are theoretically cardiovascular concerns, and one example has had coronary disease. So that's a concern to keep in mind. Following up on that last abstract, Dr. Stuart Tepper from the Geisel School of Medicine in the U.S. presented the results of a post-hoc analysis of cardiovascular, cerebrovascular, and hypertension adverse events in patients with episodic or chronic migraine, with or without a history of aura, on those patients taking mirtazapine. So this was a 12-week double-blinded treatment phase of 2,443 patients that were treated with mirtazapine at 70 milligrams or at 140 milligrams once monthly versus placebo. And of those, 1,140, so 47% of the patients, had a history of aura, so roughly half and half. Patients with or without a history of aura had similar demographics and baseline disease characteristics. Dr. Tepper noted that vascular risk factors were more prominent in the aura subgroup. At baseline, more than two cardiovascular risk factors were present in 35% of the patients with aura and 27% of the patients without aura. Cardiovascular and cerebrovascular adverse events rates were low throughout the controlled and open-label mirtazapine exposure of up to 5 years. During that period, there was no difference among the patients with aura, so there were six, and without aura, there were five. So hypertension-related adverse events were similar in both subgroups. There were 30 in the one group with aura and 37 in the group without aura. So rates of cardiovascular, cerebrovascular, and hypertension-related adverse events, general adverse events, and all serious adverse events were really similar between the placebo and mirtazapine treatment groups throughout the entire period of the study, regardless of whether there was aura or not. So in conclusion, Dr. Tepper concluded, "This is reassuring data," end quote. And the analysis of these four randomized trials collectively, together with their open-label extensions, it really does seem like the safety of mirtazapine was assessed. And the frequency of cardiovascular and cerebrovascular adverse events was comparable between patients whether or not they had aura when treated with mirtazapine. Turning to stroke, some researchers from the Medical University of Graz in Austria looked at the effects of early extubation within 6 hours after thrombectomy in stroke patients, and they wanted to see whether this independently predicted favorable outcome at 3 months compared to extubation between 6 and 24 hours. So it's an early versus late extubation comparison. So they identified all ischemic stroke patients who had received mechanical thrombectomy for anterior circulation large vessel occlusions under general anesthesia over a period of 8 years. And there were 447 patients included in this study. The patients were divided into three groups according to ventilation timing. So early was up to 6 hours of receiving extubation, delayed was between 6 and 24 hours, and late was later than 24 hours. The mean age of all the patients was about 69 years, and half of them were female and half of them were male. And median ventilation time was 3 hours. A favorable outcome, defined as modified Rankin scale scores of 0 to 2 at 3 months post-stroke, was seen in 188 patients, which is 42.6%. This correlated with shorter ventilation time in a significant way, with a p-value of under 0.001. And in patients extubated within 24 hours, early extubation was associated with better outcomes than delayed extubation. And there was a p-value of under 0.001 in that group too. And multivariable analysis also supported this conclusion. So Dr. Fandler-Hofler, who presented this work, offered a number of possible explanations and suggested that there were perhaps higher rates of ventilator-associated pneumonia in the later extubated groups, or impaired cerebral blood flow due to vasodilatory nature of sedative drugs. Hyperoxemia, which frequently occurs in ventilated ICU patients, might have played a role, and delayed early rehabilitation and stroke workup is also a fact in some of these patients. So of the 65 patients with late extubation, the most frequent reasons for prolonged intubation were brain edema at 44.6%. Insufficient alertness due to other reasons was 26.1%, and respiratory insufficiency at nearly 16%. However, delayed extubations were predicted by non-medical reasons, notably due to admission outside of core working hours, and that was a significant p-value of 0.001. So during neurointensive care unit, stroke unit lay, longer ventilation time was strongly associated with a higher rate of pneumonia, And going up from 9.6% in the early group to 27.7% in the late group, respectively. And that was a significant p-value as well. So in short, I think we can conclude from this study that early extubation within 6 hours after thrombectomy really does predict a favorable outcome at 3 months. And pneumonia rates and duration of stay of the neurointensive care stroke unit were also reduced. So ventilation in those patients should therefore be shortened as much as safely possible. In multiple sclerosis, there was an interesting abstract looking at serum levels of neurofilament light chains close to the time of multiple sclerosis onset. And they looked at whether this was going to be a marker for subsequent clinical outcomes. And it was a prospective cohort study with over 15 years of follow-up. So the correlation between the multiple sclerosis disease activity and elevated neurofilament light chains has already been well established. And researchers from the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute in Canada, they looked at the prognostic value of serum neurofilament light chain levels obtained shortly after a multiple sclerosis diagnosis to identify patients that were more likely to have an aggressive disease course. Frozen and stored samples from MS patients was provided from the biobank that was available at that hospital. A total of 67 patients were identified whose serum had been collected within the 5 years of first MS symptom onset. So the team looked at the serum samples obtained from the biobank and over 15 years of routine clinical follow-up. Patients were followed for a median of 17.4 years, with the range being anywhere between 15 to 26 years. So levels of serum neurofilament light chains was quantified in 67 patients and in 37 matched controls using a digital immunoassay technique. Of the 67 participants with MS, almost half of them were lost to follow-up, as would be expected. The median baseline of neurofilament light chain levels in MS patients was 10.1 picograms per milliliter, which is about 38.5% higher than the median level in the controls, and that is a significant p-value. Patients reaching expanded disability status scale of greater than 4 during follow-up had significantly higher, that's 73.6% higher baseline neurofilament levels than the patients with EDSS of less than 4, and that was a significant value of being 0.0001. The best cutoff for predicting progression in this study was 7.62 picograms per milliliter, and patients with baseline levels greater than that level, 7.62, had an 8.9 times higher risk of developing progressive MS during follow-up. And that was, of course, significant at 0.0034. Patients in the highest tertile of NFL levels progressed most rapidly, the annual EDSS rate of 0.16 remaining significant after adjustment for age, sex, and disease-modifying treatment. So patients with baseline neurofilament levels of less than 7.62 had a 4.3 times lower risk of significant disability. And so in short, I think it's this data look like higher serum levels of neurofilament light chains close to the time of multiple sclerosis onset with a cutoff of 7.62 picograms per milliliter does seem to predict poor clinical outcomes the higher they are. And this was a prospective cohort study, so it's with a long follow-up, and those really were the strengths of that study. Lastly, there was a very timely and comprehensive talk by Dr. Elena Moreau from Grenoble's Alpes University in France. And they presented the emerging European data of the neurological manifestations of COVID-19. Of course, COVID-19 was one of the focal issues of the virtual EAN 2020 meeting, and that was to be expected. So at that time of this presentation, about 2 million cases of COVID-19 infection have been confirmed, and about 170,000 deaths. The virus, as we know, binds to the angiotensin-converting enzyme receptors of the endothelial cells, so the ACE2 receptors. And from there, the inflammatory and thrombotic pathways are activated. The immune system is stimulated, including post-infection antibodies and cell-mediated responses. So apart from the lungs, the virus attacks other organs as well, including the heart, the kidneys, and the brain. The virus may enter through the CNS through the olfactory bulb, which is a common hypothesis, and that it from there enters blood circulation, and it probably enters neuronal pathways soon after that. The mechanisms by which the virus may inflict damage to the brain are abundant, and there may be nerve damage through direct infection, so blood circulation and neuronal pathways, as well as through secondary hypoxia and through a number of other mechanisms such as immune injury or ACE2. This may result in infectious toxic encephalopathy, viral encephalitis, or acute cerebrovascular disease. Neurological manifestations of COVID-19 patients are relatively common, but not really spoken too much about. In one of the first papers on the subject, 78 of 214, so that's 36.4%, of the COVID patients in Wuhan, China had neurological manifestations, which were more frequent in patients with relatively severe infections. More frequently observed CNS symptoms were dizziness, headache, and impaired consciousness. In April 2020, the EAN started a survey of neurological symptoms in COVID-19 patients. By May 17th, there were 4,454 respondents. Preliminary results demonstrated that the most frequently encountered neurological symptoms were headache, impaired consciousness, psychomotor agitation, anosmia, agosia, and myalgia. In the first 149 patients of the French National Registry of COVID-19 Neurological Manifestations, encephalopathies and cerebrovascular ischemic events were the most frequently reported symptoms at nearly 40% and 30% respectively. Encephalitis and polyradicular neuritis were both 8% at 8% less frequent, and meningitis and cranial nerve disorders were rare. Not a single patient was found to be CSF positive for COVID-19. In a Spanish national registry, the most frequent neurological manifestations were stroke, anosmia, and mild or moderate confusion. So Dr. DeMauro concluded that mentioning that a pan-European initiative to gather information about COVID-19, this is called, it's got an abbreviation of ENERGY, the EAN Neuro-COVID Registry. It's meant to ensure access to the most comprehensive information available about neurological manifestations for COVID-19 in a database format that's easily accessible for everyone. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and we hope to hear you next time.